Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
The conclusion is the financial intermediation theory was rejected. Banks are not financial intermediaries. Financial intermediation theory says they lend out of other people's deposits, and they don't. You may have heard of the fractional reserve theory, slightly older. That one was also rejected. So the oldest theory was the one that was found to be correct, and that's the credit creation theory. Banks create money out of nothing through the process of credit creation. Actually, the law helps a lot to understand banking, because at law, banks are essentially the opposite of what economists have claimed. Economists always say banks are deposit-taking institutions that lend money. Banks don't take deposits, and they don't lend money.
That's German professor Richard Werner, one of the world's most notable authorities on monetary theory in recent years, and the first person to conduct an actual empirical analysis of how banks create money. Those remarks you just heard might be rather jarring because they consummately dismiss some of the most common understandings about money and banking. Hello, and welcome once again to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor and Chair Emeritus to the Public Banking Institute, with another edition of Looking Behind the Curtain of Global Finance and Monetary Policy. Today, we'll hear Professor Werner's reasonably short presentation on why it matters that we understand how money gets created and why the common knowledge that money is a scarce resource doled out through the financial enterprises known as private banks is so detrimental to our growth and prospects, and how the type of lending that banks do make all the difference in our economy as a whole. Again, we see that we're unnecessarily trapped in a regime of private control of credit creation, which limits access to the most important utility with any economy, credit, the lifeblood of commerce and community exchange. Werner was speaking to a global gathering of the Monetary Institute recently, and we'll have his presentation later on in the program. The topic has a sort of heretical aspect to it, since bankers have been the principal operators of the franchise of lending, or more correctly, extending credit. Today, we're going to take you down that road a bit further, and we invite you to hang on as we scrutinize some of the background factors that drive our money machines. What impacts does this examination have on our lives, our economy, politics, and even our freedom and democracy? Lots. Money moves the world, and banking moves money, as we like to say, and the growing efforts around the U.S. to create publicly owned banks is but one example of the tension gathering around the underlying problem of why we don't have enough money to afford decent infrastructure, affordable education, health care, environmental protection, and so forth. It all comes back to money and who controls it. It's with this focus on the democratic impact of privately controlled banks that Ellen has just completed writing an important new book, which is now on its way to the publishers. It's called Banking on the People: Democratizing Money in the Digital Age. So let's talk with Ellen now about this new book of hers, and also some of the issues showing up in the monetary headlines.
Well, Ellen, it's summertime, and you and I have both been around the world a bit, and as we mentioned in our last program, despite all of our visits into other monetary systems, we come back to look at what's going on with the U.S. dollar. There are many issues we could talk about. One of them is the latest word from the Fed about raising interests. But the other thing I'm looking forward to getting into a little bit is your recent accomplishment of a new book. that has got a great deal of insight in it. So let's start with that, Ellen. Let's revisit what this business is about, the interest rate hike for the Fed. Even though unemployment is deceptively low, and even though 50% of our people are living on the edge of poverty, according to national standards, why do they want to raise interest rates? What's going on there?
Well, that's a very good question. Theoretically, it's because of the Phillips curve. We've got these models, and when it hits the model, then they have to do something about it. They rush around, and so the model is that when the unemployment rate reaches full employment, which they consider to be 4.7% unemployment, then they feel they have to do something about it. They have to tighten the money supply to prevent. The theory is that if you have full employment, then workers will demand more wages, and that will cause prices to go up. So unemployment hit 4.3%. Well, that was the official number of just people who haven't found work in the last year. That's how they count it. They don't count all those people that quit looking. They don't count the people who were part-time workers or the people that are... So anyway, and then they don't count the machines. I mean, there's a huge potential of machines to produce, and in fact, the machines are taking over a lot of the jobs. So we're not really at the point. Wages are not going up. They're not demanding more wages. So the real reason for tightening, according to Bernard Leotard, who was a central banker himself, is that their real job is to keep money tight so that people have to borrow, so that there's not going to be enough money out there to pay off their loans because they're really working for the banks. I mean, literally working for the banks. Like here, our 12 Federal Reserve branches are all 100% owned by the banks, and the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee that sets interest rates, is they do it all behind closed doors, so you don't really know what... That's another thing that should be totally open. But anyway, they do it behind closed doors, but the people in charge are bankers, largely bankers. And they have often given special favors to their own companies, for example, J.P. Morgan during the crisis of 2008. So anyway, the central banks are really working for the banks, and it serves the purposes of the banks to have tight money in order that people won't be able to pay their debts so that they'll have to borrow more and go further into debt. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is they watch the 10-year Treasury note, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note, and when that goes over 3%, which it just has apparently, then again, alarm bells sound and they have to do something about it. And their only tool is to raise interest rates. Now, if their real goal were to control the money supply, to keep it from inflating, then they could control it better if they actually made loans directly to the public or directly to, say, state and local governments. And this is what China does. It's what our own Federal Reserve did during the 1930s and 1940s. We had a mechanism for lending directly into the economy from the central government. So if they did that, then they can directly determine the quantity of money in the money supply, and they would stimulate demand by creating more jobs and creating more wages, which would be demand, in other words, money. So that would create supply. Demand creates supply, not the other way around. You've got to have the demand there first in order for producers to produce, because they're not going to make stuff if nobody wants their products. So anyway, there are better ways to do it because they think their only tool is to manipulate interest rates, and they purposely have limited themselves to that. That's what they're doing, raising rates. Right now, the yield went over 3% on the 10-year Treasury note, and supposedly that's supposed to make investors in the stock market rush into bonds because they're a better deal then. But they haven't rushed into bonds. Nothing really has happened. But if they keep on at this rate, their goal is to raise rates to 3.5% by 2020. Wow. And if they do that, according to the IMF, they'll put 20% of small and medium-sized businesses out of business because they won't be able to afford the debt. And by 2027, we'll have $1 trillion a year interest payment on the debt, which is totally unnecessary. I mean, we should have funded that debt directly through the central bank, right, as they have done or they did do with quantitative easing, and it didn't create the hyperinflation everybody was expecting. And now, besides raising interest rates, by the fall, they'll be putting $50 billion per month of the bonds they bought in quantitative easing, they'll be right. selling them back into the market. So they'll be adding even more debt into the market, more government debt.
Seems like they're driving us rapidly toward a wall.
It does, and they've done this like 15 times, but they keep doing this, and every time they do it, or virtually every time they do it, they drop rates almost to zero like they did in the early 2000s. And then that created the housing bubble, and then they decide, oh, we've got too much credit out there. And then they raise rates, and then there's a crash. And they've done that over and over, and every time it results in a crash. So not every time, but nearly every time. So they should know by now, and yet they're just repeating the same thing because it actually works for the banks. But we're at the point where it's not going to work because there's already so much debt out there that it's not going to cause people to go further into debt. It's going to cause them to go bankrupt, which
yeah.
will collapse the system.
Well, do you think that they don't know this? I mean, why would they do this?
Well,
just keep people in debt?
I think there are actually two sets of people working for the Federal Reserve. There's the Federal Reserve Board, which actually is a public entity. You know, that's the one that's headed by
Powell,
you know, Federal Reserve Chairman.
Uh-huh.
And they are subject to Freedom of Information Act, et cetera. They're, you know, they're actually considered public agencies. But the
mm-hmm.
Federal Reserve branches, the 12 branches, say that they are private. We don't get to see what they're doing. And they are the ones who determine interest rates. So some of these, like even Janet Yellen said that the Phillips curve didn't work. Their own
uh-huh.
data shows it doesn't work. I mean, so they know this, but I think there's another faction who are working for the banks, or they are the banks, you know, they're the bankers. And they say, well, it may not be working for you, but it works for us. So.
Works for us. Very interesting. I mean, I think that the obvious demise of the American consumer's standing in our ability to afford to be Americans, to be able to grow some equity, is a direction that's pretty evident. There's no question about what the impact has been on people, and it seems like our Federal Reserve System, which is neither federal nor a reserve, as you've said, is leaving us high and dry and perhaps precipitating a massive collapse of the monetary system that we've relied on once again. I mean,
mm-hmm.
in conjunction with what perceived to be an imminent collapse of the global markets, again, raising interest rates and making money more expensive would seem to precipitate that.
Right. And I know you're going to play a clip of Richard Werner. He's a German economist. And so he thinks the ideal model is the sarcasm banks, where they're non-profits, but they're not actually publicly owned. Anyway, so he would do away with central banks altogether. But I would argue, to the contrary, that central banks can be very useful,
uh-huh.
but it's just not being used in the right way. I mean, we already have this central bank that does a lot of useful things. They do something like $4 trillion worth of these Fed wires every day.
Every day.
I mean, they actually are a bank. They're a bank for bankers. We have a dual system where the banks get to trade in reserves, and we, the people, basically trade in bank money. We're just paying, trading in bank credit, and we don't get
mm-hmm.
to use the services of the central bank. But there are now these interesting proposals, I think we discussed that last time, where they would break down that wall and let people use the central bank for deposits. So we, too, could be getting 2% on our deposits instead of 0.1% or whatever, or nothing
mm-hmm.
at all. And we, too, could be using all those facilities for free with no deposit fees, et cetera. But then even those experts who are recommending that would not allow the lending services of the central bank to be available to the public. But I think it should all be available. Of course, the central bank wouldn't be able to handle all the loans of the country,
right.
but you could make them the deep pocket of a public banking system in which your local bank would be your banker who would do your underwriting for you, all those things that bankers do, but they would be able to tap into the big pot of liquidity that is the central bank. In other words, they wouldn't have to be always scrambling around to try to make their books balance, to pretend that they didn't just lend out your deposit money when you come for it.
Right. Everybody
would acknowledge that all banks do is turn your own credit into money. So the function of the banker is not to lend you somebody else's money. It's to turn your credit into money after doing their underwriting, where they check your credit and figure out how you're going to pay it back, figure out how they're going to, you know, maybe you'll post some collateral if it's a big loan, or if it's a business, maybe they'll check your business record or your business plan. We need to revision what money is and what banking is. Now that we know that banks merely create the money they lend on their books, we could just say that's what they're doing. They're turning your money into credit. You create the money. It's not really the bank. It's you, the borrower. They couldn't do it without you. They couldn't do it without a borrower. But you, on the other hand, can't. If you write out your IOU to your grocer, the grocer's not going to take it. But you can write it out to the bank, and the bank will turn it into the bank's IOU after applying all those underwriting standards. And the bank's IOU is considered official money. In other words, it trades in the market whether or not you pay.
I just had a banker raise the question about Professor Werner's distinction between the banks creating money or lending deposits. And he wanted to know, he says, is this not just a semantic difference? And of course, it isn't, because the idea of creating credit out of nothing has far-reaching implications. But the other, of just lending out the available liquidity that they have, the deposits, is, as you say, the traditional notion of what banks do. That distinction, I think, is enormously far-reaching because it empowers banks to create a whole new level of dimension in the economy. Now, Richard Werner makes a distinction about investing into the economy in twofold. He says, you know, that credit, the lifeblood of the economy, is currently invested in one of two ways. It's either invested in the real economy, which is where people, where works, products and services and all of those things get created. That's fine, but that the growing and perhaps the motivating part of the economy that bankers invest in, and this may have something to do with the interest rate rise as well, is the financial economy. Credit into financial realms of paper, derivatives, CDOs, swaps, et cetera, all of that construct. And so there's the two different dimensions of the economy. And as he points out, that financial part doesn't get reflected in the GDP, in the gross domestic product, because it's not a real thing. It's just fabrication.
Right. And money basically gets trapped in that parasitic speculative economy where it's speculators are just, I mean, including us, we're all speculators when we invest in the stock market or whatever, that they're just driving each other's prices up or buying low and hoping to sell high. So they're not really creating anything new. But the money that goes there, the profits from loans, let's say, that go into that speculative economy, they don't come back. They aren't invested into the real economy. So that would be the difference between our current private banking system and a public banking system. One of the differences, that the public entity, the Citibank or State Bank, would use the money for public purposes in the local economy. And that's what we see in North Dakota, and it's definitely been very successful there. And it's also what we see in the Sparkesson model.
With that as backdrop, I'd like to move into your recent achievement in completing this book that is called Banking on the People, Democratizing Money in the Digital Age, which I think is going to be a very powerful book once it's finally released to the public. Can you give us just a kind of a synoptic overview? There's so many important categories here, but the introduction line is, I think, says it all, that we live in an auspicious time for a banking revolution. We just talked about some of the reasons why. Tell us about this new book and what do you mean for it to bring to the conversation and to policy?
Mm-hmm. Well, it actually started as an assignment from the Democracy Collaborative. They wanted a 50-page paper on how to eliminate too big to fail and a 50-page paper on how to create a national public banking system. So it got to be too big, so I turned it into a book. But the reason regulation hasn't worked is that we're working on the wrong model. So that's what I've written about, and why that's true, and what's really happening with money, and why what really collapsed in 2008 was not the traditional banking system, which was well hedged. You know, they did have lots of things in place to prevent a run on the conventional banks. Where the run was in the shadow banks, which are not regulated. But you can't regulate them, really. I mean, you can't get rid of them because the banks rely on the shadow banks for it. That's where they get this liquidity in order to play this game where they pretend that the money they just created on their books, they pretend that they can lend this money out and they've still got it there for their depositors. They don't really still have it there for their depositors. So they have to scramble around and get it. Just overnight, you know, they have to balance mm-hmm. their books every night. But then they give the money back in the morning. I mean, it's just sleight of hand. But it's all this stuff we have to go through because we have the wrong banking model. And if everybody just recognized that what banks are really doing is turning the borrower's credit into money, we could then draw from the cloud, basically, you know, just draw from this great pool of liquidity in the sky. In other words, money is created just like in a community currency. When somebody does something for somebody else and the other person gives them some credits, that money has been created. And when those credits are satisfied, then money is destroyed. So that's also the way our banking system works. If we acknowledge that, we could solve a host of ills. So,
let me just stop you there to see if I can make a succinct distinction between the notion about money that we've had and the reality about money that you've just described. The notion about money has been that it is fixed, limited, relatively scarce, there's generally not enough, and it's almost a finite thing unless the central banks somehow operate printing machines. We know that most of our money is digital. I think most people realize that now. But still, with the notion that it might be scarce, what you're saying is that money is actually credit, and it's credit for exchange and values given and received, but that there is no limit to that. There's no confined area. In fact, money needs to be this elastic, expansive resource, and that the new forms of money that are coming into play, or the forms of them, you know, whether it's cryptocurrency or a variety of other paper instruments, digital instruments, that's the world that we need to get our heads into so that we are not so strapped by scarcity. Does that make the difference, scarcity and abundance?
Yeah, totally. And that's the nature of a community currency. It's totally abundant. I mean, it's limited by the goods and services that you have to trade, but the money itself is not a limiting factor. And then another thing, you're talking about our current system that we not only think we don't have enough money, but we also think we have these monster debts that we have to deal with, like notably all these government debts globally. I think, what is it, several hundred trillion dollars.
Yeah,
so that freaks everybody out, and then we all think we have to cut back our government services. But we shouldn't have had those debts in the first place, and you could get rid of them by just moving them onto the central bank's books, as Japan is doing quite successfully, and as the Federal Reserve did with quantitative easing quite successfully without triggering hyperinflation like everybody thought it would.
Yeah. So the sleight of hand that has been essential to modern finance actually becomes a revealed methodology about how money is created. And you also mentioned in one of your chapters that the elephant in the room is the shadow banking system, which is doing just that, creating credit, constructing money and credit out of a variety of different promises, but that they are the ones who are really the most influential.
Yeah, and that whole system is propped up by government regulation, as it turns out. It's that what they're allowed to do is escape the bankruptcy code, so they get their money out first. So that means the derivatives players get their money out first, and that is a huge potential liability of these banks like Deutsche Bank that everybody's afraid it's going to go down. So if the derivatives players get all the assets, you know, or collateral, whatever is there, then there's not going to be anything left for the depositors or the state and local governments that think their money is so secure.
Could you refresh us about the specifics of how the derivatives became the secured depositors that are going to get paid out first when the banks collapse next? It was the Dodd-Frank thing,
question.
Right?
Well, it's under the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005. Before that, repo. Repo is where it's a sale and repossession. So it's really a securitized loan overnight. It's basically where the banks borrow, unless if they don't borrow on the Fed funds market. So some investors put up the money, typically pension funds or the big funds that have more than $250,000, so they don't want to just put their money on deposit because it won't be covered by deposit insurance. Basically, repo is an alternative form of deposit insurance where it's like a pawn shop. They literally give the whoever's buying at the bank, let's say, the money, and the bank gives them some form of debt, but the seller, let's say the pension fund, actually gets that security, whatever it is. And so normally in bankruptcy, all the assets go back into the court, and then they get to figure out how to distribute them. But in this case, that the repo owners say, no, I actually owned that. This was a sale and repurchase. I owned that asset, so I'm not in bankruptcy like the rest of you guys. So they have to post some security for their derivative, and so it's considered a secured transaction. Unlike your deposits, your money that you put in the bank, you actually think you put real money in there, so you would call that security. But legally, when you put your money in the bank, you have just made a loan to the bank, an unsecured loan. There's no security. The bank now owns the money, and they owe you it back.
Mm-hmm. So the banking franchise continues to control the potential for our economy and for our communities. And your book is Banking on the People, Democratizing Money in the Digital Age. So presumably you're talking about getting away from all of this mishigas, all of this, you know, this world of whirling papers and presumptions and arrangements, and getting down to a much more basic relationship between the people and their money. As we'll hear in Richard Werner's comment, his solution to this is that we should have a network of publicly owned banks to do that.
Actually, he says private nonprofits, which is what the Sparkasm banks are. They're not publicly owned. So that was litigated at one time because some little community tried to sell their bank, and the court said, nope, you don't own it. It's a nonprofit. Nobody owns it. But it's mandated not to make profits. So the profits go back into the bank or the local community.
And, of course, that's what we're wanting to do around the United States.
Our public banks would also be nonprofits, but they would be owned by governments.
Well, what's the plan for the book at this point? When do you expect that we can see it in public?
Well, I think they said they wanted to have it out by the end of the year, so I'm not sure what they what they do with it for 6 months. But
well, there's so many great topics in here about, you know, why regulation hasn't worked, for example. And why is that, by the way? Just why doesn't regulation work in this industry?
Well, because they're regulating the wrong thing. They're aiming at the banks, which are already quite heavily regulated. So, for example, if they raise capital requirements even more, in terms of loans, like loans to local businesses, they're already operating on quite thin margins. They're not making much money, contrary to what people think. Banks do make a lot of money, but it's not on the loans that they make to local business. So if you raise their capital requirements even more, if you make it even tougher for them with all this regulatory compliance, then they'll just quit lending to the local community, which is what they pretty much have done. They've turned to, instead of making business loans like they used to do, credit lines to businesses for, say, 8%, now they make the business fund their ongoing proceedings with credit cards, which is double the interest rate. Mm-hmm. So credit cards are a lot easier to do for the banks, and they escape all these regulations. So it's not good for us. And if they realize what the problem is, I mean, to the extent they have tried to regulate the shadow banking system, they can't really do it because the shadow banking system is part of the whole banking system. So you also don't want to make it so that they can't operate on a profit, because then they won't operate and then we won't have a banking system.
Well, we'll wrap up this section, this conversation, because there's so much to talk about here. An auspicious time for a banking revolution is the heading of your introduction. And you open up by quoting Henry Ford's pretty well-known comment at this point, that it's well that the people of the nation don't understand our banking and monetary system, because if they did, there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning. Yeah.
Yeah, we have revolutions going on all over the place, and that was largely triggered by 2008 crisis and people's total disillusionment with the banking system.
And when the next crisis comes forward, will we be in a position to do something different? And I think that's one of the things that the public banking movement around the country is certainly trying to address, is that what we want to do is create publicly owned banks that will be able to secure the financial assets of the community in something solid, in an institution that's solid, that cannot be drained by larger powers. As you say in your introduction, you know, when the next crisis hits, the rules will no doubt just be changed again as they were in the last crisis. Instead of letting these banks collapse and nationalize them, you know, they'll probably be making exceptions for their friends. So this is an important point for the people to be learning, is that our money is at risk in the current banking structure, and that we must provide some public option to the institution of banking so that we can secure our interests against the vagaries, the vicissitudes, if you will, of the global financial cartel. Well, Ellen, thank you so much for this, and congratulations on getting this book wrapped up, at least from your perspective. We will be talking more and more about it. As I look at the chapters, I think they're great discussions for us to have together.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ellen.
Now let's go to that presentation by Professor Richard Werner to the Monetary Institute. It's a presentation that's packed full of insight that may reshape the way you think about the role of banking in our national economies, beginning with his claim that banks don't take deposits and they don't make loans. Here's Richard Werner.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I would like to go straight into my presentation about the source of money creation and its allocation. And the underlying issue is central planning versus decentralized decision making. Now, banking actually has not been very well understood. There have been three theories of banking, and they've existed and coexisted for at least the past century. The most dominant one currently is still the financial intermediation theory of banking. And nobody had ever done an empirical test. So I thought, well, you know, since these theories are mutually contradicting, when it comes to the crucial question of where does the money come from when you get a loan from the bank, well, let's figure it out. Let's do an empirical test. So I did this and published 2014 and 2016 two papers. The conclusion is the financial intermediation theory was rejected. Banks are not financial intermediaries. You may have heard of the fractional reserve theory, slightly older. That one was also rejected. It says that, you know, banks lend money out of reserves, and they don't. Financial intermediation theory says they lend out of other people's deposits, and they don't. So the oldest theory was the one that was found to be correct, and that's the credit creation theory, which was known 100 years ago, which is why one of the papers is called Lost Century in Economics. Banks create money out of nothing through the process of credit creation. I know there's some lawyers and experienced lawyers in the room, and actually the law helps a lot to understand banking, because at law, it's very clear, banks are essentially the opposite of what economists have claimed. Economists always say banks are deposit-taking institutions that lend money. Banks don't take deposits and they don't lend money. They don't take deposits because they borrow from the public. A deposit suggests something held in custody, a bailment, and this is not what happens. Instead, the money that you lend to the bank, which they call erroneously a deposit, is actually their money. They own it. It's just a loan. You're a general creditor. And banks never lend money because, and that's unlike firms and non-bank financial institutions, they are in the business of purchasing securities. When you get a loan, the loan contract is a promissory note, just like the Bank of England promissory note, of course, not legal tender, as you may have noticed, but the bank will purchase that security from you. That's what it does. And now it owes you money, and it creates a record of the money it owes, which we call deposits. And that's how the money supply comes about. So you get a loan, £1,000, let's say. The loan contract is purchased by the bank. It increases the bank's assets, and the bank then records the money it owes you, which it calls, slightly incorrectly, a customer deposit, because no customer has deposited this, and in fact, nobody has deposited this anywhere. It's not transferred from anywhere inside or outside the bank. It's created out of nothing. These fictitious deposits are our money supply. So banks are special. They create the money supply, 97% in most countries of the money supply, out of nothing, through the process of what's called credit creation. That's, of course, also why, actually, central banks have been all along monitoring bank credit quite carefully, whether they announce this or not, and they've been guiding bank credit. And, of course, central bankers have been quite aware of these facts. Now, the recognition of bank credit creation is a game changer to solve many of the world's problems, such as the recurring banking crises can be prevented, unemployment can be solved, business cycles, underdevelopment, depletion of finite resources, all these problems can be solved by utilizing the power of bank credit creation. And this is something we'd think about before we decide to abolish it, because this power can be harnessed. So can we achieve high, sustainable, stable growth and development without crises? Yes. This is the fundamental basics. This is how the economy really works. So the money supply is actually credit, let's call it C, and we have to disaggregate it, because the crucial thing is who gets the money for what purpose. Simple disaggregation into the real economy, CR, and the financial transactions, financial economy, CF. So if banks create credit, it's used for financial transactions, the left side. This is, of course, one example of unproductive credit creation. You're pushing up asset prices. This explains in aggregate asset bubbles and all the large asset movements. It's simply credit creation for asset transactions. That's not part of GDP, because GDP is value added. And of course, that doesn't add value. It's a zero-sum game. But it will create banking crises, because once you've pushed up asset prices by 300-400%, they just need to drop by 10% and the banking system is bust, because equity is less than 10%. Now, when banks create credit for the real economy, for real transactions, we still have two scenarios. One is easily understood. If they create credit for consumption, you suddenly have more demand for consumer goods. And if they do a lot of that, of course, you get consumer price inflation. That's what most people think of as the central scenario. Well, it's actually only one of three, and the one that we understand best, and really not the most burning one, because it's been financial credit. But there's a third scenario, and that's when banks create credit for the real economy, but it's used for business investment in the creation of new goods and services, productive investment or implementation of new technologies. That creates growth without inflation and without crises. And as long as you ensure that bank credit creation is used for the green box, you get high growth, no crises, and no problems. So why haven't the central planners at the central banks ensured that? Well, they have in some countries, but not in others. And I think that's really the first issue we have to address. There's more to this, and of course, in the 12 minutes, I won't have time to address this, but if you split this credit creation, you can explain GDP growth very nicely in many countries, asset prices. Japanese asset bubble is just credit creation for asset transactions. When this doubled from 15 to 30% of total credit, that was the 1980s bubble, and Japan is still trying to get over that. So total bank credit in Japan was expanding at massive growth rates, way ahead of nominal GDP going into asset markets. Didn't have to be a rocket scientist to know that a banking crisis was coming next. So the wrong allocation of money creation for asset purchases, that is the problem. And we need instead productive loans for business investment. So the key question is, who should make this decision? It seems the regulators, the central banks, actually had forgotten to tell the banks, oh, by the way, you should only create a productive credit for sustainable business investment. That way we could have prevented all these boom-bust cycles and crises and all the inequality that's been created as a result of this. So now that we've uncovered this, what should we do? Who should make this decision? So the question is not really banks versus central banks. Should we take the privilege to create money from the banks and give it to the central bank? It's really centralization versus decentralization. Should this decision be made by central planners or in a decentralized market-based fashion? What's the scientific way to tackle this? Well, let's look at the empirical evidence. Let's look at the historical record. So what's the evidence on centralized decision making? The idea to abolish bank credit creation and centralize the decision of the quantity and allocation of the money supply in the hands of one group of central planners is not a new one. That's how the Soviet Union ran its economy for half a century. That failed spectacularly. So let's keep that in mind. China, by the way, learned the lesson, Deng Xiaoping, from 82 onwards, changed its financial system and introduced banks, introduced decentralization with hundreds, if not thousands, of banks creating credit locally and making that decision locally. And of course, China thrived in the economic miracle of double-digit growth that was based on that. In fact, it used window guidance of bank credit to suppress, in the high growth phase, the financial credit and the speculative and the consumption credit. Another example, evidence of centralized decision making, the UK. Now, the UK has a very centralized and concentrated financial system because just five banks who, as we know, collude in many ways and fix things, make all the decisions. 90% of deposits are with them. So centralized decision making in the London headquarters has not delivered very good results. By the way, there's reports on this. This has been recognized again a century ago. The big five dominating, lack of competition, the big five failed to provide long-term investment. All these things were announced in a report in 1918. Of course, could have been written yesterday. So if you look at bank credit in the US, in the UK, then 90% is asset credit creation. So credit for financial circulation, the CF, and of course, that's no good. And that's the problem of centralized decision-making. The central planners like an easy life, and they think that's good for them. It's not good for the economy. Another piece of evidence on centralized decision-making is the ECB in the 2000s. So credit creation in Spain, Ireland, Portugal, and Greece was expanding by 30-40% under the watch and auspices and supervision of the ECB. As I had warned, the ECB was going to do this, create asset bubbles, banking crises, and recessions in the Eurozone. And of course, that's what it did. So again, the problem of centralization in the hands of these central planners. Another example, Japan in the 80s. They used the window guidance, credit guidance tool until the 80s for good purposes. But then the central planners, because they're unaccountable and too independent, decided, oh, let's create a bubble. And they announced their window guidance loan growth targets. And I pressed the button, you see the actual result 3 months later. Banks had to follow, and they had to increase their lending for real estate speculation. And that's how the Japanese bubble was created by the Bank of Japan. So centralized decision-making has failed. The evidence on decentralized decision-making is from China, as I mentioned briefly, and Germany. Germany actually has been very successful, its economy, for 200 years. And its exports are often larger than Chinese exports, although the population, only 6% of the Chinese population. How is that possible? In fact, if you look at market champions, these are companies that are number one, two, or three in terms of market share globally. And hidden champions are small firms that are global market leaders, global champions. Germany has the largest number of hidden champions, small firms that are global market leaders, by far of any country. The US comes second, Japan, and so on. How is that possible? Most exports from Germany are from small firms, family-owned businesses. Well, it's because of the community banks. And the community banks in Germany, there's 1,500. It's the largest number of banks in the European Union. Big banks lend to big companies, small banks lend to small firms. Germany has lots of small banks. Decentralized decision-making, that's been highly successful. 70% of banking, the green two segments, are with not-for-profit community banks. We already have public money creation in the form of local community banks, not-for-profit banks. So that's unique in the world. And that's delivered high growth without the bubbles. So central bankers create cycles. How have the central bankers reacted to the truth coming out? They admit that they've been telling porkies, and now they propose to increase their power. So central bankers belatedly admit, now that you've mentioned it, yes, banks create the money supply. Let's abolish that now. And also, by the way, let's abolish cash. So what should we do? Well, introduce digital cyber currency that central banks issue and control, and thereby gain total control over all economic transactions, decisions, and the whole lot you've just heard from the CEO of the GDI. So the greatest concentration of central banking power in history is really the bid they're aiming at. That's the central bank's goal. And of course, digital accounts of dissenters and regime critics could be switched off. It'd be very difficult to even purchase necessities. So this is an Orwellian dystopia of total control, the end of any freedoms. That's really what central banks are aiming at. Several central banks have, like the Bank of England, already prepared their microchip implant, RFID chip, to be implanted under your skin. And why is the sudden discussion about universal basic income from all the grassroots and inverted commas movements and billionaires? Oh, universal basic income is the bribe for you to accept the microchip. The overarching trend of the 20th century is concentration of power in the hands of the few. That's what we have to keep in mind. We have to work against this. We don't want to have these unaccountable central planners making decisions. We need decentralization, and the solution, therefore, is to maintain public money in the hands of local community banks, decentralize decision-making, give local people the power in the form of local public banks and local not-for-profit community banks. As I walked in, I was delighted to see that the Gottlieb Duttweiler Institute is also about Genossenschaften, cooperatives, and of course, the majority of banks in Germany are cooperative banks, and that's really what we need. So we shouldn't really abolish banks. We just have to get rid of the too-big-to-fail banks, introduce a few rules that you create credit for productive purposes, and then we can solve many of the world's problems. And these are really the promises of economics, that we can solve a lot of mankind's problems. As JFK said, our problems are man-made, therefore they may be solved by man, and man can be as big as he wants. Of course, he was referring to ladies as well, no doubt. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. JFK, thanks very much.
That was Professor Richard Werner of the University of Southampton in the UK, speaking recently to the Monetary Institute. We found this particular presentation of interest because it makes the points that we've fostered here so often, namely that the importance of local credit creation cannot be overemphasized, particularly when we look at local economic stability and potential. Werner's observation that big banks lend to big customers, leaving smaller businesses underserved, is a market reality around the world. So when we discuss creation of local public banks, publicly owned or community banks, and the someday potential of networking these banks into regional financial powerhouses, we're taking a strategic position for building local economies that are free from the world of fantasy finance fostered by the global banks. Local economies and governments around the world need access to affordable credit, which is why the movement for creation of public banks in the U.S., in its cities, towns, and states, is gaining such momentum. Werner's empirical proof that economies are more stable when banks are publicly owned and controlled, with a focus on local investment, brings it all together. Our thanks to the Monetary Institute for letting us use this audio. You may be aware of Meyer Amschel Rothschild's quote, in which he says, "Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, keep that in mind as you listen to commentator Bob Bowes talk about American history from our beginning through to today.
While the powers that be leverage the public holidays, the flag, and the military to instill blind patriotism, true patriots today, like the founders, should be seeking a new social contract, one which restores and expands the rights of the people, because, according to the terms of the Declaration of Independence, the original contract between the people living in these United States of America and the federal government is irretrievably broken. Here are the steps taken that facilitated this breach of contract. One, the story of the usurpation of the sovereignty of the USA begins with the Declaration of Independence, which declared that 13 former American colonies of the Kingdom of Great Britain were now united but sovereign independent states. Next, the sovereign states allowed limited power to a federal body by approving the Articles of Confederation. A guiding principle of the Articles was to preserve the independence and sovereignty of the states. 3. This federal body was granted specific expressed powers and denied all unexpressed powers. In short, however, another constitutional convention was held, and in 1789 the government under the Articles was replaced with a federal government under the Constitution, which was strengthened by a chief executive, courts, and taxing powers. 4. Then the sovereign states added protections for citizens by instituting the Bill of Rights, a set of specific guarantees of personal freedoms and rights, clear limitations on the government's power in judicial and other proceedings, and explicit declarations that all powers not specifically delegated to Congress by the Constitution are reserved for the states or the people. 5. However, around the same time, the federal body created a privately owned central bank in response to debts incurred from the Revolutionary War, namely 600,000 pounds sterling in reparations to Britain, which supposedly lost the war. Alexander Hamilton's plan included creating the first Bank of the United States, for which the government would be a minority stockholder, with foreign bankers holding 80% of the stock. This plan was opposed by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, who held it to be unconstitutional, as Article 1, Section 8 states quite specifically that only Congress could create money. However, President Washington signed the bill. By 1796, the government owed the bank $6,200,000 and was forced to sell its shares, and by 1802, the U.S. government owned no stock in the First Bank of the United States. When the charter came up for renewal in 1811, President Madison refused to sign it, and Britain, at the behest of the banks that controlled it, began the War of 1812. A series of attacks on American merchant ships and other aggressions organized by the British bankers, as well as the internal needs of the fledgling nation, resulted in a charter of the Second Bank of the United States. When this came up for renewal in 1832, President Andrew Jackson insisted that the bank was corrupt and unconstitutional and refused to renew its charter, resulting in a depression as promised by the bank's executive, Nicholas Biddle. 6. For the next 28 years, the European banking cartel worked ceaselessly to regain financial and political power over the USA. But the cartel's plan was threatened by the original 13th Amendment, which gave teeth to the constitutional provision that forbade anyone with a foreign title from holding office. 7. Next, the foreign central bankers financed the arming and secession of the Confederacy. The strategy employed by the cartel was to split the Union and draw the nation into the Civil War, where each side would amass large debts. This is the same strategy the cartel used in Europe to destroy sovereignty. 8. As a counter to the bank's strategy, the Union issued greenbacks. Apparently, the banking cartel thought that Lincoln would have no choice but to borrow capital at a diabolical interest rate between 24 to 36%. However, Lincoln and his advisors chose to issue sovereign dollars, greenbacks, on which the nation did not pay principal or interest, to outfit and underwrite the Union Army. 9. Congress outlawed the further issuance of greenbacks. This was the next big unconstitutional breakthrough in the conquest of the USA. The National Banking Acts of 1863 and 1864, giving the cartel control over the money supply by requiring the federal government to issue bonds and pay principal and interest on those bonds in order to receive private bank notes, which had become by default the unofficial legal tender for all debts, public and private. Essentially, the Civil War was not won by the North or the South, but by the cartel, which split the Union, put it into debt, and in the ensuing chaos, deleted the original 13th Amendment. 10. In 1866, the banking cartel reestablished the gold standard, causing a drastic shrinking of the money supply and depression throughout the land. By 1871, riots broke out across the country, with many voters calling for the use of greenbacks and silver. The bankers clearly felt threatened and responded with even more severe measures, including the demonetization of silver in 1873. 11. Finally, on December 23, 1913, with a significant share of Congress already in recess, the Senate passed the Federal Reserve Act. With the cartel now in control of the central bank, and after the establishment of a federal income tax to pay the interest for the use of the cartel's private paper, the focus for bankrupting the United States shifted to maximizing the debt owed by the U.S. and its newly conjured taxpayers. 12. The First World War, followed by the Roaring Twenties, which ran up private, personal and commercial debt, creating a surfeit of collateralized assets which were later acquired for mills on the dollar when the cartel crashed the system and imposed the Great Depression on the planet. During this severe contraction of the money supply, the federal government was in need of massive funds to rebuild the nation. There was only one entity that possessed the license to print the requisite banknotes needed to pay for the New Deal, and that was the cartel's Fed, as the central bank of the U.S. Thus, the U.S. was an insolvent public sector subsidiary corporation and was forced into a form of national bankruptcy, with the international banking cartel gaining effective receivership. 13. With control over their U.S. proxy fully implemented, the next step of the criminal corporate banking syndicate towards global hegemony was the Bretton Woods Conference of June 1944. 40 years after that, David Rockefeller declared in a speech to the Bilderbergers that the New World Order had sewn up control over the planet. With the printing press for the world reserve currency in hand, the few families that own the Fed and other key central banks gained control over most of the key corporate and government assets on this planet. Next on the cartel's agenda is the privatization of the biosphere. 105 years after the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, the ravages of the financier's strategy are transparent. All resources on this planet, animal, vegetable, and mineral, are valued only according to their profitability. This means everything, including water. Thus, the cartel's action begs the question. Clearly, the old social contract, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, has been totally inverted by those who have hijacked our government, as their agenda makes crystal clear. Thus, in this 242nd year of a nation that was conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, we must declare a new social contract, independent of the Anglo-Euro-American banking cartel, by which such tyranny shall not be tolerated. Reporting from behind the curtain, this is Bob Bowes.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.